Merry Christmas. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. It's been an extraordinary year, that's putting it rather mildly. But for our final program of 2020, we're putting pandemics and politics aside, and we're focusing on some inspiring music and fascinating literature. We'll begin with the music. Derek Peter is a Danbury, Connecticut-based folklorist, performer, and composer. And he's fascinated by the human voice. It's vital to the art that he creates. A year ago, he was doing research for a solo album. He came across a collection of traditional folk songs from the Library of Congress. One specific recording set Derek on a quest to find the Appalachian connections of a 500-year-old ballad. We'll let him tell that story. And Derek Peter joins us on Skype. Derek, hello. Welcome to The Full Story.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for having me.
I'm eager to learn about the ballad that you found, but first, could you tell us what took you in the folk song direction to begin with?
Well, I've always enjoyed folk music from around the globe. It's just mostly been music from Southeast Asia or Africa that I initially had listened to. There was something that was sort of a pre-Wikipedia that maybe some people remember as a CD-ROM called Encarta Encyclopedia.
I remember that.
And it had a world music tour on it. So I would really enjoy a lot of music from, I guess, what they call the Silk Road territory, like North Africa and Indonesia and Thailand. And Encarta would sort of get over to like Memphis blues and rock and roll and Elvis. And it, for me as a young person reacting intuitively to that, it wasn't as exciting as this other folk thing. But certainly more and more I've listened to, I guess, what people would consider folk music from this country. I've always loved Joni Mitchell and slowly began listening to people like Gene Ritchie or Judy Collins. Even in England, there's Shirley Collins and June Tabor. It was just like a slow progression over to Appalachia, which is what I discovered in a big way last year when I was doing some research for a record that I wanted to make. And I came across a compilation by the Library of Congress that was called Anglo-American Ballads. I think there's just two volumes of it. And it was volume two that really spoke to me the most.
Let's talk about that one particular tune that grabbed your attention, Bolakins. I did listen to it, and it's an old recording, dates from 1939, I think, and it's kind of scratchy, and it's a little bit hard to understand, but you heard through all that, and something really clicked with you on that.
Well, I, for a long time, wanted to get back to making acoustic music, and I sort of tackled this a little bit for myself in 2015. I made a record that had a bunch of woodwind arrangements on it because I think I'd gotten so far into making music on a laptop that I was kind of like, all right, Derek, are you a capital M musician or are you just a sound collagist? You know, and I wanted to sort of get myself back on music, and I'm kind of coming around at that again. I wanted to make a record that was just completely acoustic. So I was doing some immersion listening for different kinds of acoustic music that I wanted to make. Just to recenter my vocal practice, I was listening to these Anglo-American ballads. And as you say, certainly they're older and the quality is thin or scratchy or sort of degraded. But there's one line in Bolakins that goes, "We'll stick her little baby full of needles and pins."
Oh, my.
While I was doing my background research, just sort of listening to these compilations while I was scrolling through doing whatever other work, that popped out. And I said, what is this song? And I needed to know more immediately.
Let's listen to a bit of that that recording from 1939.
Bo Lincoln's was a very fine mason as ever laid stole. He built a fine castle and the pay he got none. Where is the gentleman? Is he at home? He's gone down to Marion for to visit his son. Where is the lady? Is she at home? She's upstairs sleeping, said the foster to him. How will we get her down such a dark night as this? We'll stick her little baby full of needles and pins.
So that's Lena Turbefill. Where did the ballad come from, and what story does it tell?
Well, Bolakins is like a diminutive, or has lost a couple of syllables from a pretty standard Appalachian ballad called Bold Lambkin, which is in turn kind of a specific variant of this very old Scotch song called Lambkin, L-A-M-K-I-N. And That ballad is part of the Child canon, which basically means there was a man named Francis Child who kind of sorted through the most popular English and Scotch ballads that were still being performed. He chose about 300 songs. There's 305 that he decided to categorize and give numbers to. So Lambkin happens to be number 93. Of all of the child ballads that are sung, Lambkin is certainly one of the strangest and the bloodiest. And I came to find that out as I was doing research. In child ballads, people often die. They die of heart sickness, or they've lost their love, or they're old, or they're waiting too long for someone. It's usually centered around love, and they pass away. And usually something beautiful and hallmark happens. A rose will grow out of their grave or something. So death is not uncommon in these ballads, but Lambkin is certainly one of the most gruesome or violent of the deaths that occur in these ballads. So that was definitely an intriguing story to kind of gain more context for.
I'm talking with Derek Peter, a Danbury, Connecticut-based folklorist, performer, and composer. So, in your research, you came across this collection of songs, and you were going to go to the Library of Congress, listen to them, and then digitize the collection. That didn't happen, and that led to a trip to visit the actual family of Lena Turbefell, her descendants. Could you sort of walk us through that part of the story?
It's not purely a curiosity about Lambkin, although it is a fascinating ballad. I was also really struck by Lena's character. I don't think you can hide in your singing what sort of character you have. I think, if you're a violin player and you have a cold, no one will know. But, with vocal music, you can tell age and gender and what shape the person's in, and, sort of their geographic background and whether they've had a good day or not and what health they're in. And it's a very transparent thing. And certainly hearing Lena sing, I was really struck by just her character. She has a warmth and a humor to her, and a clarity that I found really refreshing. I've listened to a lot of vocal music over the years, and something about her really stuck out to me. But the only other published tune I could find was her and her sister Lloyd singing another murder ballad, a more recent murder ballad called Lily Shaw, which is also a really gruesome story. So I had this very kind of sharp and warm woman singing these kind of awful songs, and I just found it a really interesting juxtaposition. So I wanted, as you said, to go to the Library of Congress in person. Halpert had made about 30 recordings of Lena and other members of the family.
Halpert being Herbert Alpert, who through the WPA recorded quite a bit of music in the in Appalachia and down south, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Halpert was sort of a contemporary of Alan Lomax, although I don't think Halpert is really discussed as much as certainly many people know who Alan Lomax is. His journeys documenting Southern singers, and especially Black prison singers, was quite famous. But Herbert Halpert is a little bit more obscure. I think Herbert Halpert did some super invaluable work and documented the Turbefell family quite extensively. So my plan was to go to the Library of Congress and retrieve these songs and select which ones I wanted to digitize. But my appointment date was March 18th.
Ooh, bad timing.
And I don't have to tell you what's wrong with that. So it never came to pass, and the library remains closed because of the pandemic. So I just sort of took matters into my own hands, and just through research on the internet, got in touch with Carlos Hicks, who's Lena's grandson. Grandson being sort of a deceptive term because he's in his 70s, and by extension, the rest of the family. Lena has one daughter left living, Nicola, or I call her Nikki, who lives only about 500 feet away from Lena's old house in a little town called Elk Park, that's in Avery County of North Carolina, so right on the border of Tennessee in the Blue Ridge Mountains. So I went to visit Nicola at her home, and wouldn't you know it, the only song that she could remember her mom singing was, in fact, Bo Lakin's.
And can I ask you, what kind of reaction did you get from the family when, as a stranger, you approached them about something as personal as this music?
Well, I lost my grandmother 2 years ago, and I would say if someone called me out of the blue and said that they knew her and wanted to see how I was doing, I would definitely be wary, if they just had kind of a general inquiry. But I think if someone were to call me and say, "Your grandmother won blue ribbons for her apple pies," year after year, which is true. Could I get the recipe? I think I'd be a little more receptive to that. I think to have pride in someone's accomplishments and a goal and in communicating with them, putting myself in the family's shoes, I think I would be receptive to that, because they certainly were very receptive. And in a way, this was not new information. They were aware that Lena had been chronicled in folk journals and released on these records. And Carlos's wife, Diane, is the daughter of a pretty famous, what they call Jack Tales teller. These are these Appalachian folk stories that are not sung, they're spoken. So it wasn't totally unbeknownst to the family, and they were pretty happy to be interviewed and recognized for this stuff.
We're talking with Derek Peter, a Danbury, Connecticut-based folklorist, performer, and composer. Could you tell us a bit more about the song that you heard Lena sing on that old recording? That's the one complete song that her surviving daughter, Nikki, remembers?
That's right. And it was kind of an unbelievable coincidence, because I remember I finally got on the phone with Nikki, and she has these very rare carcinoid tumors in her lungs that are pretty unusual and not often seen, and she's got arthritis and some other medical issues, so she was sort of hard to track down at first. I remember the first phone call we had, that was the first song she told me she remembered her mom singing, and I almost fell over, you know, because, you know, out of all the songs Lena knew, you know, it's just so funny that the one that I had come across was the one she remembered. But I think it's because of the content of that song is so alien. And she told me that, you know, when her mother would sing it, she'd say, "Well, Mama, did they really stick the baby with needles and pins?" You know, and she'd lie to her and say, "No, it's just an old story. You know, it's not real." But I think that the ballad does have historical basis. Lena passed away in 1968. So Nicola hadn't heard that song probably sung in well over 50 years. So the fact that she remembered it was incredible to
me. So she hadn't heard that recording.
She had not, and so I told her that she couldn't do her homework. I field recorded her singing for me on her couch, sitting next to her, and I said, "Now you can't do your homework. I have your mama's recording, but I'm not going to play it for you until you give me what you know." And it matches up really well, and then I did play her mom singing, and she was in tears because she hadn't heard her mom in over 50 years.
I think we also have the recording of Lena's daughter, Nikki, remembering singing that song.
Daughter Betsy climbed up in the tarot so high and saw her father come riding hard by. "Oh, father, oh, father, can you blame me? Oh, Boykins has killed your baby. Oh, father."
A recording of Nicola, or Nikki, Lena Turbefill's daughter, singing the one complete song that she remembers her mother singing. And we heard that original recording earlier, recording made back in 1939 by Herbert Halbert through the WPA project in Elk Park, North Carolina. Derek, you also fuse this rich oral tradition with your own work. I believe you recorded a song, a version of a song, a ballad called Barbary Allen.
That's right. That was sort of the point of this initially, was I was going to record, and I did complete a record for my own solo work of mostly original songs. I did actually end up doing a version of Bo Lakin's on this record because I just was so enwrapped by this whole process that I felt like I had to do a version myself. You've asked about kind of the tenor of the family and how receptive they've been, and you know, Nikki and I talk about once a week now, and she's one of the most inspiring people that I've ever kind of spoken to. You know, given all of her medical hindrances, she's one of the most optimistic, knowledgeable people. And in the 70s, she'd read an article in a magazine about dyslexia, and her son had been struggling in school. He would know all the answers to all the tests, like when they'd study at home, and then he wouldn't pass the test. And so she kind of put two and two together and brought this article into her son's teacher, and basically diagnosed his dyslexia ahead of the school system, which I found like totally pioneer. And, you know, she's just a wonderful person. And I've really enjoyed getting to know her and understanding a lot of her life and how much she was able to provide for her family. You know, this is a life that I didn't expect this project to take on. I'd been awarded a grant by the Danbury Cultural Commission to write a solo album because I had recorded one last year and they'd worked with me on that. And so I was just setting out to do another record and didn't think that I would ever had this sort of side life, but you know, one of my goals was certainly to expand my own practice and sing different things, incorporate different styles into my solo work. And so some of those practices have been recording traditional ballads. And so the version of Barbary Allen that I chose is also a North Carolina version from a place called Boiling Springs. And it was sung by a woman named Mrs. G.L. Bostick, who I don't have that much information on, but I really enjoyed her melody. And actually, it's the same friend that I mentioned earlier in the program who I'd met 15 years ago. He came kind of for a little vacation from Massachusetts to my house in Connecticut, and we just sort of set my field recorder up and recorded a very impromptu version of that ballad, that melody. And I didn't think too much about it until I was going through recordings, and I thought it was actually a great document of, to me, it sounds a lot like the old field recorded ballads that were taken decades ago.
Let's listen to a bit of Barbary Allen, Derek Peter with Reuben Walton.
One day in the month of May, when the flowers were a-blooming, young Johnny Gray from West Tennessee fell in love with Barbary Allen. He sent his servant to her door, unto her father's dwelling. My master says you must come there if your name be Barbary Allen. Slow lad, she got up, and slow lad, she went to him, and all she said when she...
The ballad Barbary Allen, Derek Peter, who we're talking with, singing there along with Reuben Walton. There's a term that I find fascinating that you talked about in one of the articles I read about your project, and that's song catching or being a song catcher.
Well, I think as long as there's been the means to record audio, there's been a desire to capture sort of like a snapshot, right? An audio snapshot of folk life. I don't know who came up with the term song catcher, but it's been around for a while. And in fact, there's a wonderful movie. I think it was made in 2000 called Song Catcher. It sort of loosely is based on Cecil Sharp's efforts in field recording. And if folks want a clearer picture into how this folk music came into wider focus for us as a nation, I think Songcatcher is a really wonderful introduction to that, because it takes place about 100 years ago in the rural South. And this woman had gone down to, I believe she was visiting her sister who was a teacher, and sort of like me, was just found herself, you know, in the midst of these beautiful songs that these people in the community knew. And she had a huge desire to transcribe and record them. It's definitely something that has taken a lot of people's imagination in the last 100 years.
Will you be doing more song catching yourself, do you think?
Well, Nikki is not the only person I'd recorded on that trip. I tried to make a point to set up a couple of other engagements. I met this fantastic banjo player called Charlie Glenn, and I'd met a couple of other people in North Carolina, and I certainly have a taste for it now and want to get back out as soon as I can safely do so. Obviously, that's completely up in the air at the moment because of all the surging that's going on with the second wave. But one of my things that I can do is I have a whole collection of what I call phone ballads, because I'll get on a phone call with someone and interview them, and they'll just start singing. So I get my recorder handy, and I have, you know, some remotely recorded ballads that I've been able to capture. But certainly I want to get out into the field as soon as I possibly can.
Derek, thanks so much for your time today and telling us about this really fascinating project with little-known music that's really so rich with American heritage and European heritage as well.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Tom. It was a pleasure.
Derek Peter is a Connecticut-based folklorist, performer, and composer. Science fiction writers challenge their readers to view the world we live in from a different point of view. Consider the fanciful work of H.G. Wells' Time Machine or Isaac Asimov's I, Robot, Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, or the dystopian visions of George Orwell's 1984 and Margaret Atwood's A Handmaid's Tale. What we'll explore next is the urban science fiction of Chase Bowling. He grew up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and describes himself as, quote, a father, avowed revolutionary, and author in that order, end quote. He's also the managing editor of science fiction, fantasy, and speculative fiction for W. Clark Presents Innovative Publishing.
Yes.
In his three-part series, Vanguard, Bowling takes readers into a post-apocalyptic world where all guns, arms, and weapons of mass destruction have vanished. But brutality has not. And Chase Bowling joins us now. Mr. Bowling, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having me here.
Oh, my pleasure. How would you define the science fiction genre generally?
Usually I look at science fiction and really what separates it from fantasy as you take technologies that aren't quite real yet, you know what I'm saying, and expand upon them and basically add a level of realism, you know what I mean, as opposed to a level of the fantastical. Like when you look at the difference between a movie like iRobot, you know, that's science fiction. It's a level of technology we haven't seen yet, you know, applied to human circumstances, whereas something like Lord of the Rings is fantasy and magic has taken the place of science, so to speak.
Now, your work, and I mentioned this earlier, your work has been described as urban science fiction. What does that mean?
Pretty much my work takes place in a setting and environment with characters coming from a perspective that's uniquely urban. A lot of times in fantasy movies, you see guys like, you know, the main character is a farm boy. He comes from a rural background. You know what I'm saying? And the city is something he comes to as part of his journey. Whereas our heroes, they start off in the city. The book is based in Bridgeport. And I think what separates it the most is most of the story takes place in the urban environs of Connecticut. You know what I'm saying? It starts in Bridgeport and we start to see other areas of the state as the story progresses. And so I really think what makes it different is the fact that my characters, when you read it, it reads very much, it has a vibe like Street Lit or a hood movie like Boys in the Hood or Straight Outta Compton. But the action and the events taking place is something we are very much used to seeing in things like The Hunger Games or Game of Thrones.
And that's something that other forms of science fiction don't really offer, at least not that I'm familiar with.
Oh, yeah. Now, it's definitely something that's not very common. We had to thank the late, great Charles R. Saunders for bringing us Sword and Soul, which is kind of like epic fantasy or sword and sorcery, but set in the pre-colonial Africa. You know, I was introduced to this genre as an adult. My brother had always told me about Emerald growing up. He's like, you got to read this book. It's like Conan, but he's black, and it's set in this medieval Africa, and it's really great, and we could never find a copy. And so I finally got to read it a few years ago, and it blew my mind, and it really changed my perspective. And I wanted to bring something like that to the sci-fi realm, but with a more contemporary setting, because representation is important. You know, I have a son who's 8, and I could see the impact watching Black Panther had on him as just a little guy. And that's something that, you know, even when we were young, I mean, we had Spawn, you know what I'm saying? And being from Bridgeport and Michael Jai White being from Bridgeport, like that was a big deal for us around here. But like, it was nothing ever mainstream like that was. With Black Panther and what we got to see with the representation of Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa. And so I really wanted to bring something like that home, in a sense, to where, you know, audiences could have a sense of ownership of, you know, what they're doing. Because our big thing at SFF for the Culture at Wahida Clark Presents is impacting reality with our fantasy. You know, everything that we deal with today, from our cell phones to what our cars look like to, you know, the Google Home stuff, all of that came from a sci-fi book, you know, or a movie at some point. And so if we impact people's fantasies and their fiction, it inspires them to create a better reality that we live in. And that's our hope and that's our goal.
Are there other authors or films or TV series that influenced you and challenged you to write urban science fiction?
Definitely. I can say Charles Saunders, Milton Davis was big. Christian Cameron was a huge influence. Like, I'm a huge sci-fi fantasy geek, you know, like I have been since I was a young guy. And so I can definitely say like Christian Cameron, Milton Davis, Game of Thrones was obviously like a huge influence because I had read the books years ago. And so when it came on HBO, I was like, see, everybody, look, this is what I was talking about. And so it was like such a vindicating experience for everybody to love it. And that really inspired me to want to create that kind of imagery, but like I said, with a sense of ownership and familiarity to people that come from my background.
What do you enjoy most about writing science fiction? Obviously, your affinity for it is huge.
Yeah. I think the best part is I got into the genre growing up because it offered an escape from what was going on. You know what I mean? So it was like, take me somewhere that's completely unlike what I am currently existing in. And so having a chance to write it and create my own world and settings and scenarios, I think it gives me that sense of escapism while still being able to say relevant things about the world that we live in and humanity at large. And I think that's my favorite part, is I get to kind of run away, you know what I'm saying, but still keep the perspective and the link and be able to say things that are relevant.
I'd like to talk a bit about the first book in your Vanguard series, The Road to Resistance, where you kind of throw the reader into a world that's been dramatically transformed, really in an instant. All weapons are gone and the internet is not working. Would you read an excerpt of that for us?
Certainly. Guns had disintegrated. Piles of dust and display cases and gun racks. Airfields were turned into scrapyards. Warships, submarines, and aircraft carriers had been rendered just functional enough to evacuate their crews before falling into scrap. Missiles and all other forms of destruction were rendered useless components only fit to recycle. Any armed vehicle was also left dust and components. For a moment, it exploded, and wild stories were everywhere. Then it was as if nothing happened. Mass media silence on the subject. Police departments were ordered to use whatever force they needed to maintain order. Martial law was on the table. But it was all hush-hush, though. At least this is what my alternative news media sites said right before they disappeared, when hacktivists had immediately gone hot in the info war with the feds. The internet, which had flickered to life and worked for all of 40 minutes, went dead again. Confused, most people understandably went to soft form of 8-bit, but nobody rioted yet. People didn't know how mad to be without social media and the internet to tell them. Instead, they glued themselves to the television, inconsolable at the loss of guns and internet, waiting for news.
You take on a lot in that excerpt. Wow, the role of guns and weapons, the role they play in our society, how we rely on social media for information and technology for just about everything. Why did you choose this approach, this topic, a world without guns and technology as we know them?
Part of it is because I'm one of those guys where I like to read a lot of sci-fi and fantasy, but I'm very persnickety, right? So if I'm reading a fantasy book, it totally breaks the magic whenever a gunpowder weapon comes into play. Right? Because to me, I come from a military family. You know what I'm saying? I come from a background of civil service. The closest thing to a father I ever had was Marine. My uncle was a Marine. My family believes in guns. You know what I mean? But for me, I think it's more interesting and it makes for a better story without all of the tools of modern combat. You know what I'm saying? It gives it some of that warrior mystique that you're missing in tales like Saving Private Ryan or a lot of Tom Clancy's work. You know, think about how more epic it would have been, you know, if the guys were fighting each other rather than shooting at each other. And I wanted to be able to highlight the importance of the fact that even if today, even if you wiped out all modern weapons technology, human nature doesn't change. People are going to fight. People are going to protect themselves. Like, no matter what you do, you can't regulate humans being humans. And with gun control being such a hot button issue, especially being from Connecticut, like I come from a place where my family wouldn't have survived without the rifle on the mantelpiece. You know what I mean? My ancestors owned land in Copiah County, Mississippi, and they were literally black folk owning land in the sea of what would become, you know, one day the KKK. And there were several clashes and instances where my family were literally forced to defend their land. And if not for the Second Amendment or the right to bear arms and be able to use them, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you today. And so it's one of those things where I wanted to paint the issue kind of counter to what the mainstream has to say, if that makes any sense. Because we don't understand necessarily the role of media and culture and presentation and culture, which is why with the guns going and the internet going at the same time, people are kind of just left lost. You know what I'm saying? Because you have this certain segment of society that's like, you know what? I'm armed, I'm prepared. Whatever happens and comes my way, I can deal with it. Boom, now you have no guns. And then you have this segment of society that kind of relies on the constant influx of information from the internet to make their decisions, right from things they purchase to what they're going to do to protect their family in a state of emergency. And now when you get rid of that, people are kind of forced back to the methods that are working. And when you move around the prepper community and you talk to different people, they say that's one of the first things that'll happen in any major emergency is the internet goes away. So that way the state can control the narrative. And so I wanted to kind of set that scene and throw the reader into that mindset and that environment of like, this is our reality. It happens just that fast.
You mentioned earlier too that you grew up in Bridgeport. How much of your life in Bridgeport is reflected in your work? You mentioned the setting for the story is in Bridgeport. How much of your life comes into the story?
Quite a bit, actually. You know, when I sat down to write and I was thinking about what to write about and doing different workshops and looking at stuff, they said to write what you know. And so that's like what I did. And I thought it would be interesting to see a perspective kind of similar to that and that of my friends. Like, we're part of what you would call blurred culture, even though we didn't have a word for it growing up. Like, these kids just kind of have it made now. But we were into anime and historical martial arts and fantasy books long before it was ever cool. You know, like, there was a certain point in time where you couldn't talk to people about The Hobbit on the east end of Bridgeport and anybody know what you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to bring that to life. You know what I'm saying? What it was like coming up in Bridgeport just a little bit, being from that social subset and how the city itself responded to it.
In a previous life, if I could ask you about this, you worked in the indie hip hop scene as the legendary Thug Poet.
Yes, sir.
What took you from music to literature?
Really, it was kind of a simultaneous thing at first. I was still rapping and making music, and I had gotten to writing because my wife and my nephew had encouraged me to write. You know, life was a little crazy. I had writer's block when it came to the music. And so my mom was sick. My wife was pregnant with my youngest daughter. And, you know, the only father I ever had was sick. And so I kind of just sat down. I couldn't make any music. So I said, I'm going to write a story, you know, because real life is not working out so well. I don't like this world, so I'm going to make my own. And hopefully things will be a tad bit more fun. And so that was kind of what started the journey. And then in 2019, I was in a car accident. And I sustained a traumatic brain injury and some neurological damage that kind of just made rapping something that I can't physically do effectively or efficiently anymore without having migraines and stuff like that. And so now writing has kind of filled the void of expression for me.
I was reading your bio, and in it you say you grew up participating in marches and canvassing for political campaigns. Would you say you were an activist in those days?
Born and bred. I don't really think I had a choice. My aunt was active politically. She was an older woman back when we had such things in Bridgeport. Now they call it the city council. The first big march I can remember was marching against Mount Trashmore.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I remember that that story. It was literally a mountain of trash.
Literally. And so I remember being on the front page of the Connecticut Post with my aunt, Mary Brantley, marching against Mount Trashmore. And then after that, like, my family just has this thing about civil service and giving back to the community. It's like a GIS. Like, ever since Lincoln's Loyal League, my family has been about political action and community service. Way back in the 1800s, I'm pretty sure like 80% of Lincoln's Loyal League in Monticello, Mississippi were my ancestors. And so it's a tradition that's been passed down. And so, yeah, I'm definitely an activist. I don't get out and do as much as I used to, but throughout the course of my life, I started off canvassing for the late Senator Alvin Penn. I don't know if you remember him.
Mm-hmm, I do, yes. I interviewed him in City Hall, I believe, at one point, yes.
Yep, and so that was my godfather. And so that's who I really started working for. And, you know, they set my feet on the road and it just continued into adulthood. You know, after high school, I worked for Acorn for a little while. I went away to school. I came back. I moved to Rhode Island and I worked with the Rhode Islanders United for Marriage. And we won the historic marriage vote in Rhode Island. It was something they had been trying to do for so long. And we were finally, you know, the team that finally helped get it done. And it was a really, really good experience for me. I was proud to be able to stand up for the LGBT community and continue my family's legacy of activism. And then after that, I had kids, I kind of slowed down. Now, this past year, actually, I think I went and I spoke at the Juneteenth march held by Enough is Enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a really good experience. I was surprised at the turnout and I was really pleased. And so I'm looking forward to doing more as the world opens back up, just because we're in a point where we've gotten our guy, or, you know, who most of us thought was going to be the answer to our problems in the White House. That doesn't mean we just stop the activism and the mobilization and trying to make our communities better.
I'm talking with urban science fiction author Chase Bowling. Did the protests following the murder of George Floyd while in police custody in Minneapolis, did that feel different to you, especially the aftermath, again, the protest, than earlier movements for racial justice?
I think that what we hit was a certain point of grief, right? I can remember when uptake kind of started after Trayvon Martin. Right. It was like one of those things where we don't know whether to be desensitized to it, because it's not happening more or less than it ever has. It's just televised now. And so I think what happened is once we started to see, like, hey, listen, OK, you're doing this on camera now in front of people, like, this was just so unnecessary. Like, there's nothing to say that you feared for your life when you had your knee on a man's neck. You know what I mean? And I think that that is what changed the tone, right? There's no, what do they call it in law enforcement? Reasonable doubt left, you know, to say, oh, we weren't there. We don't know what happened. No, we know exactly what happened. That man knelt on George Floyd's neck until he died. And I think that's kind of what changed the entire tone to almost the levels of what we saw in the aftermath of Rodney King or the Watts riots, where people are just, you know, shell-shocked into nothing but anger. It's the only thing left to feel. And so I definitely think that it was a difference in timbre to what we saw in earlier protests. And this is why we started getting the calls to defund the police. Because, you know, now this isn't something we could legislate or fix. It is what it is. It's occupation by forces that you don't know whether or not they're there to really help you or protect your community. You know what I'm saying? So what do you do then? Where, what step is left? Like, we had been marching, we had been protesting. Like, where do we go from here? And so I think that's what really changed the game after George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis.
Can I ask you that question? Where do you think the movement for racial justice will go from here?
That's a great question. I think what's going to happen is we're going to see two things go on, right? We're going to see a level of entrenchment on one end of the spectrum, right? Where everybody's going to dig in and stick to their guns and double down on what they know. And then what we're also seeing is people saying, hey, I want to be an ally in the true sense of the word. Let me educate myself. Let me cross the line. Let me do what I have to do to make sure I'm not part of the problem. And that's always going to come with a certain backlashes, because at the end of the day, up until the 60s and the 70s, and really up until what we call political correctness, racism was part of the culture. It's at the heart of Western civilization to say, hey, this is the right way and the only way to do things. I don't know if that makes sense. But I think that we're at a point where things can change, but it's not going to be the windfall like we saw in the summer with everybody saying, hey, we stand with Black Lives. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's going to take more than a summer of action and a summer of corporations and political entities showing up and saying, hey, you know, we support you guys. It's going to take putting your money where your mouth is. So I think that we've started walking the road, but I think that we need to push continuously to get to a point where we can start to heal as a nation and as a people.
It certainly has been an extraordinary year, unprecedented year, with the movement for racial justice, the election, the pandemic, very challenging times. I'm wondering, will this year and what's happened this year influence your work, your urban science fiction writing?
And it's funny you ask that. I'm in the process of writing the fifth installment of the Vanguard series now.
Ah.
And I'm finding that it definitely, you know, when I first started writing the books and I started painting my post-apocalyptic, post-collapse America, I wondered whether I was bugging, whether I was going too far. You know what I mean? And then we had the pandemic and Tiger King and just everything that's happened. I was like, oh, maybe I didn't go far enough. And so it's definitely given me more insight into what I want to do moving forward with world building. And what it's shown me is the American resilience that our ancestors had. You know, we talk about the generation from the world wars, and that's the greatest generation. Like, that resilience hasn't disappeared. I think that for everything that's going on and has gone on, I can be, as an American, proud of my people. And I think that that's something that's going to take center stage moving forward. It's like, this pandemic has shown me what our nation is really made of. Everything that's happened this year, you know, it's like M. Night Shyamalan was writing the script for life this year. And just seeing how everybody bounced back and handled things and the support for the essential workers and how people did it. You know, our government tried and they did what they did with the stimulus, but it's people supporting one another, you know what I'm saying, that I think has gotten us through this. And that's definitely going to be something that takes a role moving forward in the series that's really made an impression on me as an author.
You're the managing editor of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Speculative Fiction for W. Clark Presents Innovative Publishing. I'm wondering, in that role, what trends in this genre are you noticing from newer or young writers today?
What I'm seeing is a lot more magic. You know what I'm saying? I put it like this. There's a certain level of timidity that comes with trying to write what you think people want and write what you want, you know? And I tell all my authors all the time, write what you want to say. It's only a bad book if you didn't say what you wanted to say. And I think that that's something that we see now, is more authors are coming up and they're saying what they want to say. They're amplifying themselves. People are just coming out, they're writing their books, they're telling their stories. And I'm seeing a lot more people of color in speculative fiction over like the last 3 years than I have in the last 10.
Chase Bowling, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I've really enjoyed talking with you and hearing about your take on science fiction. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a great conversation. And I like I said, I grew up listening to NPR, and I am just so pleased to be here, and everybody listening, I hope you guys enjoyed the conversation too.
We absolutely, absolutely did. Chase Bowling is an urban science fiction author, and he is also the managing editor of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Speculative Fiction for W. Clark Presents Innovative Publishing. And that's a wrap for our final show of this extraordinary year.
Our show is produced by me, producer Fatu Sungari.
And me, senior producer Ann Lopez.
And me, Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story. We'll see you in 2021.